Today we're going back to Series 1, to the Pathways to Parenthood episode. In this one we break down and talk honestly about the different routes to becoming a parent. We break down IVF, ICSI, IUI, donor sperm, adoption, all the stuff that no one really explains when you first walk into that clinic. The big takeaway from this episode was, it doesn't matter where you are in your pathway to parenthood, there are options, and none of them make you any less of a man or any less of a father in the future. Also, if you feel like you're struggling at the moment, please know that you can reach out to us. We're here to listen. You don't have to navigate this one on your own. All the details are in the show notes. Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support, and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. Hi, I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode.
Hello and welcome to the fifth episode of the Male Fertility Podcast. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. I've got a very bruised leg, as you know, which I sent you a picture of earlier.
I did read this message, and you've just jogged my memory. What actually happened?
Oh, mate, I genuinely can't even really explain it. This is yesterday, but I went for a walk, and I got a bit lost, and I live on a hill, and you can see this church from miles away, which is on the hill. So I was like, I know which direction I need to go in. So I was walking through fields, and I came to this like wooden fence to a farmer's field, and I just went to climb over it, but it was like really rickety, and I've got to the top and just gone to jump off. But as I've like pushed to jump, I admit, I don't even know what happened at this point, but it's like gone from underneath me, but then sprung back, and I've just like what hit it with all my weight on the outside of my left thigh, and I'm like 6'2", and I think about 95 kilos at the moment, and then like you got the downward force as well. I was in so much pain.
Didn't I? There's the adult part of me that thinks, oh, that was really, when it came through, I was like, oh, that's serious, that. But then that little boy inside me that will always be there just started laughing.
Yeah. Oh, mate, I got home. So I was limped home. Honestly, I was in so much pain. What was really funny, though, is like this was next to this really, like, really amazing, like, lottery home. And I had, like, I've been looking at it as I was walking through the field. I was like, you know, just imagine living there. And I've jumped over the fence and, like, kind of, it looks like I was, and then there's this lady like, walking her dog. And it looked like I was kind of making a quick escape. I was wearing a hoodie. So I'm thinking, I think she just thinks I burgled the joint. And then I'm like limping off. And I was like, hello. She didn't, just looked away or scared. And I'm like, oh, God. But yeah. I got home and Jenna was like, what's the matter? Because I was laughing. But I was kind of like laughing, but in so much pain that it was like I just couldn't like get my breath. And I was just trying to say I've fallen over. And then Evelyn came out and was like, what's going on? Like, what's the matter, Daddy? And I said, your daddy's an idiot. He's 40 years old and he's fallen over. I said, I shouldn't be falling over at 40. And I've hurt my leg. And I showed her at the time. It hadn't come up much. But then she went, oh, I have a bad leg too, Daddy. It was really sweet.
Yeah, they always try and, it's amazing, little ones. They always try and comfort you.
Yeah.
I always like adults just laugh. When things like that happen, it's like, that's funny.
You dick. Yeah. I think that's pretty much what Jenna said.
But Jen never gives me sympathy. But like, if something happens to me, Garen, I'll get it off the kids. Even if I don't want it, they'd be like, "You're right, Dad. Sit down." And then Enya will go and get her little like. She's got a thing about plasters.
Oh.
Like we go through plasters, like I don't know, like ice lollies, mate. They just go. So. I always get a plaster, even if there's not a mark there. If you, like, I've got a headache. I get a plaster on the head, you know. but it's amazing, isn't it? But the wives, mate, no sympathy.
No, absolutely none. No, and you know, yeah. So that's that. If I sit down for more than about 10 minutes, my leg starts seizing up. It's like ultimate dead leg. But other than that, all good. I've got some. I'm joining that big headphone hype like you today.
Yeah, man.
So. Yeah. I'm feeling a little bit like Tim Westwood, to be honest.
Tim Westwood. We better not mention him at the moment. He's got some stuff going on in the media, isn't he, a couple of months ago. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't watch or read any of it. I cut it out during COVID. It's been great for like mentally. Just not knowing what's going on in the world. It's great.
Well, a lot of it's just noise, isn't it?
people.
Yeah, that's what it's designed to kind of
trying to sell stuff.
Keep us down. It's depressing. So I just stopped consuming it. And I always say the news I need to know finds its way to me.
Oh, 100%. 100%. I wonder if there was anyone out there in the world who didn't know about COVID.
Mm.
Like, obviously, in the Western world, they wouldn't have got away with it, but there must have been places in the world that.
Yeah, just like tribes in the Amazon and stuff.
Yeah, just not aware of it. Yeah.
Mate, we're getting off on a tangent.
We are. I'm all right, mate. Busy day, as I told you. But bonus today was went to see Enya's, like, not, it wasn't a nativity. It was like six songs that the nursery had put together for us to sing to the parents. And it was great. So Enya has spent the last 2 weeks singing these songs in the back of the car. And yesterday I tried to sing along with her and I was told very aggressively, "You do not sing, Daddy. I sing on my own." So I was like, all right. But today when I went to watch her, she sat there and didn't mutter a word and just looked at everyone like as if it was complete stage fright. She did a bit of the actions and stuff, but I think there was a lot of people there and she positioned herself right at the front. It was very cute. And in the older ones in the nursery, like, did amazing. So in the back of my head, I thought, well, that'd be her next year because she's new to, she's only been going like two terms. So she's still finding her feet and she only goes three times a week. So it's the Christmas experience, singing and everything like that for people was very different and new for her. So, yeah, that was my highlight of my day.
Bless her.
Yeah. She's at her auntie's at the moment. So she goes on a Wednesday to sleep at her auntie's house. So it gives us a bit of chill out time, you know, because it can be very intense. As you know, you've got two of them, mate. I've only got one that age, but I can only imagine how intense it is with two.
Yeah, it is. But on that note, actually, how was your Christmas?
It was good.
I tried to throw you there.
Yeah, you tried to throw me, but no, it was good, mate. I'm looking forward to it.
You've had it.
By the time people listen to this, we would have had it, but it's not quite Christmas yet, is it, mate?
No, it's still early December, but we're recording this one, which will be going out on the 27th, which is that weird week in between Christmas and New Year.
Yeah, so we hope
really knows what day it is.
Yeah, we do hope that everyone's had a good Christmas. We know, both of us know how challenging Christmas can be at this time of year with social gatherings and things like that. So, you know, look after yourselves, put yourselves first, and make decisions that maybe people won't fully understand. The people that need to understand will one day or do now. So don't stress too much. Look after yourselves. But I guess that moves us on nicely to what our topic is going to be today. So we're going to be talking about the different pathways to parenthood. Because originally we kind of named this podcast or this episode Different Pathways in Fertility. But as I texted it earlier, mate, that title didn't sit right because it kind of, you know, is making a statement that is specifically about like fertility treatment. And we both know that, you know, for some, that isn't an option and there are other options. You went down the donor route and there's also adoption and things like that. So we're just going to have a chat about things today, aren't we, mate? Just kind of, what's the options, what to expect maybe in the more, I don't want to use the word common options, but the more frequently appearing things that people will come across when traveling this journey of fertility.
Yeah. So that's it. And because we were both the same and many, many people are the same in that you get thrust into this world. You have no idea about fertility treatment. You find yourself in this shitstorm, and then suddenly you're getting all these new terms thrown at you as well. So we're also going to talk about assisted conception, i.e. fertility treatment, and what that can consist of, some of the different options that are available and routes that are used. I mean, like, just some of the terms just like that we're going to say now, for example, ICSI. I mean, everyone kind of knows IVF. That's become a bit of an umbrella term for fertility treatment, but that's actually not the same as ICSI or IUI, for example. So it's important. We're going to give a very broad overview of what they are. But, and I think we also need to heavily caveat at this point that we're not scientists or we're not embryologists. We are not experts in this field. We've walked the walk. We know a little bit. But if we could just give a little bit of knowledge about what they are to better arm people who find themselves in the same situation, then it would put people in a slightly better position than what we were going into it. Like me, I think I said before, didn't know my arsehole from my ear hole.
And no.
On top of that, you're dealing with all the stress, the grief, the upset. So just like, you know, get a little bit of, impart a little bit of our learned knowledge.
Yeah.
Definitely seek professional advice when exploring any of these options.
100%. I echo that, mate. It's just being that voice of these are the things we wish we'd known maybe a little bit more about. If we kind of felt like that, other people are going to feel like that. I mean, just before we came on air, I said to you, mate, that what I now know as ICSI, I thought that was IVF. I thought it was all done like that. And obviously we'll get into a bit of detail in a minute. But it's things like that. Like if you're brand new to it, you're not going to have a clue, are you? You know,
no.
Because it is a completely different world.
And that was one of the first terms, actually, that when we finally got referred onto the fertility clinic, that was kind of thrown at us, was ICSI. Oh, yeah, we'd be looking to do ICSI. And I'm like, well, what's that? Like, I thought we'd come here for IVF. And yeah, definitely. Like, and ultimately, they are different because that, you know, that's the professional then saying what they are intending, and it is different to IVF. So, hey, we've talked about it. We may as well start there with ICSI.
ICSI. Now, do you want me to give it a go?
Yes, I do, because I've heard you try. What's the what's the full word, full name of so ICSI?
This is just a disclaimer to anyone listening. I am extremely dyslexic in reading, but he's left me with this job. So I'm going to
get... You're making me sound like a flat track bully now.
No, it's fine. So it's intracytoplasmic sperm injection. Is that right?
I think it's intra.
Intra.
So, yeah, intracytoplasmic sperm injection.
Injection, yeah. But you so commonly, like, I know exactly what it is, and it's so commonly referred to as ICSI.
Yeah. You don't need to know that.
But when you're sat in a consultant room and they suddenly say that long word, you can almost be thrown back in time and think, well, what the fuck is that? When actually you just know it as ICSI.
Yeah. And I don't think that the full term was ever actually said to me. So it's only when I was writing it down, build up to this episode, I was like, oh, right, okay.
That's what it stands for.
The only thing we brought it in for in this pod was a bit of comedy for hearing Kieran say it.
Hey, mate, I went to a live event and I've got to say it.
I'm definitely writing that down for you to bring up again.
So I guess we better explain what it is, really. So
yeah.
ICSI is basically traditional IVF. I think if we did the traditional IVF first, because that's what people are going to know, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, go on. You do that now. I'll talk about ICSI.
So the traditional IVF is intravenous fertilization. And that's
or
when...
in vitro fertilization.
It depends how you say it. It's IVF, right?
Yeah.
So what they do, basically, they put the egg and sperm, so multiple sperm, into a dish and the sperm naturally makes its way into the egg like it would within the womb. It's a lot less invasive to the egg compared to what ICSI is. Now, ICSI is when they have an egg and they take a sperm and they inject the egg with that sperm. So they don't put it into the dish and kind of let it do its natural thing. They actually inject the sperm into the egg. Now, obviously, like, you might be thinking, well, why would they do that for some? Why would they give some people ICSI and let some people have IVF? Now, the main reason they do it is if, say, the male or the sperm quality is poor, And so they have to kind of identify the good sperm, and they will use one of them to then inject the egg. So
in ICSI.
In ICSI, yeah, in ICSI. Mm. So if it's like IVF, they'll just pop it in into a
dip. So IVF is kind of more typically used when there's potentially low sperm counts, but for example, your morphology and motility are of a decent standard.
Of a good standard, yeah.
And then, like you said, they're in the dish, that is, they're doing their own thing more naturally, and that can be used as well in kind of where there's been previous unsuccessful treatments otherwise, such as IUI, which we'll come on to, or in cases of unexplained infertility, IVF then becomes a bit more common.
Yeah. Yeah. So going back to the ICSI. So if you've got, like you've just said, mate, if you've got like poor quality sperm, low mobility, you know, everything's not looking good for you in terms of your sperm quality, they will direct you towards using ICSI. And it was, IVF was never an option for me. It was straight away, ICSI needs to be, is your way forward, because your sperm quality and volume and everything else was so low. So yeah, that's the main difference. If you're looking at IVF, it's more of a in the bowl, one egg, multiple sperm, more of a natural penetration of the egg. ICSI is an injection of the egg with one sperm.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, so typically ICSI would be used when there's low or poor sperm quality. And then like this, select the best option and inject it directly. If, for example, when I had my micro-TZ, if they had found sperm, it still would have been ICSI, because they would have selected, post the surgical sperm retrieval, selected the best option. And that, again, it's very commonly used when there has been surgical sperm retrieval.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's actually, ICSI is the most successful treatment for male infertility or male fertility issues.
Yeah. They also might opt to do it on the day if the sample you give isn't as high quality as they expect. They might then opt to go down the ICSI route rather than the IVF route. But that can happen on the day. So if anyone's listening and suddenly that pops up, that's not unnormal. They'll go with what they've got on the day and do the best possible treatment route for you and your partner.
Yeah, and we've actually, we've got an embryologist who's going to come on to a future episode actually and talk more in detail about that and what goes behind that decision-making and a whole array of things, which give that kind of that expert practitioner point of view from what goes on behind that scientific wall of, well, we're on one side, they're on the other.
So it's what goes on behind that little, once you've posted that sample through that patch.
Exactly. They're the ones on the other side. That'll be a great chat. I'm really looking forward to that. So
it would be.
That would be coming in a future series. But then I touched upon briefly on IUI, which I didn't actually write down the full term for that.
Is it intravenous insemination?
Yeah, something along those lines.
Intravenous insemination. That was pronounced okay, I think.
Yeah. So that is where that's used, where sperm is being donated more commonly. For example, in female same-sex couples or single females choosing to go down the fertility route.
Yeah.
And or can be if, for example, in a heterosexual couple where there's a physical disability which prevents people having sex.
Yeah.
This is used. And it's a lot less invasive procedure. It's literally sperm is injected directly into the womb and then left very much kind of natural selection and the inverted commas kind of normal way of fertilization happening. But because of that, it's a lot less successful and it's actually, I think, the least successful form of fertility treatment. But it's a very, very popular one because it actually, you know, it's the cheapest one as well, from what I understand. But actually, in the UK, it's not typically funded by the NHS, so that was never an option for us, even though we eventually went down the donor sperm route. That was never even on the table, never offered.
No, it's something that I've had no kind of interaction with, because it wasn't an option for us. We didn't discuss it. So it's something like, just doing the research for this podcast is something that I've looked into, and kind of all I can do is echo what you've just said in terms of the reasons why.
I think it's a lot more prevalent in America. A lot of people I speak to through Instagram. People often ask, like, whether my wife and I went down that route. And so, yeah, I think it's a lot more popular over there.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there'd be reasons for that as well. You know, we're not going to get into those, but obviously it's more popular elsewhere in the world. I guess we should also talk about, you know, we talked about IVF and we talked about ICSI, and kind of maybe the process that you go through if you're, you know, if you go down the ICSI route, in terms of when treatment starts to when a transfer occurs. So the first thing that will happen is your partner will start medication, and it always happens like it's the first, they have to let them. Jen had to let the clinic know when she was it was her first day of her period. So what they do then is they give a medication to basically stimulate the production of embryos after that period. So you can have a long or short protocol in that period. And obviously the long ones take a bit longer and the short ones take a bit shorter. I'm not going to go into massive amounts of detail, as it's as we've said, it's an overview, but it's just to be aware of. In the clinics, you'll have those conversations with your consultant. And then they obviously collect the eggs through egg retrieval. Once those follicles have developed in their ovaries. And that's where you'd give your sample as a man. And then they put them together. However, they're going to put them together. So we've already talked about the IVF and the ICSI. So whichever one they choose. And then the embryos would then start to develop. And they'd either transfer them back in on day 3 or day 5. Ideally, you want them to go to day 5, because that's a full thing, that is something called full blastocyst, and the embryo is at its healthiest point for a transfer. So that, I mean, that's real, like a nutshell, like a very brief kind of description of what to expect.
Yeah, and I think, like, for any blokes kind of wondering how that goes, it's not easy. It's like, you know, I think I said on the first episode where I was talking about our story in full, but like Jenna had a needle phobia, so suddenly she, each time we did the injection, she was on long protocols, which is about a month, every day injections. It has to be in a very short window, I think around 2 hours, if memory serves me correctly, but it's going back kind of 6 years or so now. But so, you know, you've got all the drugs at home and you're having to do this, and you're on your own. You get this chart, you know, ticking it off every day, and it tells you exactly how much to do. And like you said, you will inform the clinic when the female starts her period, and then they tell you exactly, you have the drugs already, and then they'll tell you exactly what day you start on. So then you're off, really, whether you go for the short protocol, which is obviously shorter, or longer. The longer protocol. And then essentially the first part of that is down regulation. So it's like the medicine taking over the lady's natural cycle, because obviously that the normal monthly cycle will produce one egg. This is down regulating that. And then once you finish that element, you then move into the stimulation phase, which is then stimulating as many follicles within which the eggs will be as possible. And in our case, as I said before, Jenna was overstimulated. So she produced 26 eggs, 13 on each side. And so that was an awful lot. And that obviously had the repercussions and her illness because of that. And yeah, then, like you said, the end goal is to have an egg retrieval. The final part of that, actually, you're going for a scan in the days towards the end of it. And they'll tell you when to have a trigger shot, exactly when. You have to have it exactly when they tell you, because that is the kind of final oomph has to do with the kind of egg making process. And this is definitely the caveat comes here about us not being scientific and experts. But then you'll go in for the egg retrieval. Quite often, if people are having surgical sperm retrieval, for example, that will sometimes or quite often be tied in with that egg retrieval date. So the bloke were going for their op, the woman were going for their op, and then ideally then it all happens at the same time after. Or, you know, in certain cases, people have that backup option of donor sperm. If should the surgical sperm retrieval not work, they'll have donor sperm that would have been selected and ready to push the button on. We didn't do that. We were holding out for the surgical sperm retrieval, my microtesy, and then when it didn't work, we then froze the eggs and took everything slower, and I had to kind of get my head around the donor side, the final kind of step of that. So yeah, it's, you know, it's all very timetabled, it's all very structured, and you are, you know, very much in the care of the clinic, and they're there for any questions, and of which there usually are lots, because it is quite overwhelming at times. And it you know, when you're, like I said, you're at home with all these meds. I remember the top shelf of our fridge just being absolutely chock-a-block with boxes of medication.
Absolutely.
Cupboards full of needles. And then you've got the safety box things for discarded needles, for used needles. It's like your home becomes like this mini pharmacy. And it's like we said before, this is all mixed in with the upset and the trauma and the needle phobias and everything about it. It's all one big bomb, really, of overwhelm at times. But you do it. And I think for us, mentally, what helped was having that chart of the protocol. It tells you literally every day. It's got its like tiny prints. It's got the date, what you're having, how much, and that can change. And then you go in for the scans, and they might tell you to like reduce the dosage a little bit or whatever. But having that chart, ticking it off every day, that was hugely beneficial for us mentally, chalking off those days. And then actually, you know, when you get a week in, 2 weeks in, suddenly then over the hump and you're on the downward slope and you're getting towards the end, you really start to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Because I remember the first ever one that Jenna had to do, and like sat there with the needle for... So I think, yeah, it was pretty much... I'm pretty sure it was a two-hour window you get.
Yeah, it is. I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah. So we like prepped it at the beginning of that. I think she literally sat there fretting about it until about 1 hour and 55 minutes in. It was just like, I've just got to do it. And that was a huge step, getting that first one done.
Yeah. I mean, you've got into some real like description there. And as you're saying it, all these memories are just flooding back for me. Like, I remember that. It's, I remember that final trigger. Injection being really like a pinnacle moment. It was like, this is it, we're going.
It's massive as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah,
it's thick, you twist it to do the dose, and yeah.
It's because you know, as soon as that goes in, it all starts in terms of the egg collection is going to happen, and then the next bit's going to happen, and then, you know, in terms of whatever treatment you're going to have is about to occur. And it can seem really like out of worldy, like not quite real. Like you're doing something that feels very unnatural. It does. You know, it's not like people make out about how a child, you know, babies should be made, and you feel really kind of, I certainly did. I felt it was really like just unnatural, and I found it really hard. Especially thinking that we're going through that because of me.
Yeah. There's a lot of guilt wrapped up in those periods, especially when it's male factor, and you just like you feel that you are solely the responsible for putting your partner through all this pain, and it's really hard.
Yeah, and basically, what I want to kind of say is to guys that if you're feeling like that, I'm going to say that's a completely natural thing to feel, because you're processing what's going on. And just remember, you're not the only guy that's, one, going through it on that day, and two, that has ever been through it and people will go through it again. But when you when you're in that position, like finding support is really important. You know, to get those, get talking at that moment.
And I think like what I did to help me in that, like try and get over that guilt, was play my part in that that process and prep the injections for Jenna and like have her chilling out on the sofa as I was doing it all, because you've got to be really careful not to get bubbles in it, for example.
So yeah, yeah.
To get one bit out, and so like you've got to be careful to only put the needle in the little vial once if possible, because it blunts the needle each time.
Yeah.
And like if there were times where I couldn't be there to get the injections ready, if I was working or whatever, I'd leave notes in the vial, like the little liquid, just saying like love you, like stuff like that, like you got this, just little things that just helped me play my part. Us men, we like to do that. We like to feel that we're useful, and that was a really useful thing for me to do, and it helped me, it helped her, of course, especially when in the earlier days, like got to a point where she's barely looking, she's just like right, stabbing it in. But then there were times where she was very bloated, very swollen, very bruised, because you alternate which side you do it on in the abdomen.
And it kind of gives like, one side of... just becomes a pinprick in the end, doesn't it? Like there's pinpricks all over the stomach.
Yeah.
And I found that harder. You know, the early days, I was very much like, let's just get it done. And Jen was the same. But as she became more uncomfortable, because it does become uncomfortable, that's when I struggled. And but being present with her doing it, it is the best thing you could do, I feel, for yourself, but also for your partner. You know, you're in it together. She supports you when you need it, and you support her when she needs it. You know, you've just said it yourself. It does make it a little bit more manageable.
Yeah, because like it's like you said, and like and I, you've got that guilt, and you feel that we're only in this situation because of me, and then I bet you your Jen said it, because my Jen definitely said it. It's no, we're in this together. So then like then to echo what you just said, is that then it is dragging you in and pulling you in as that couple, and playing your partner in the whole process. And again, for me, I essentially just tried to do anything I could to remove the burden from Jenna. So like keeping track of the dates, when stuff was happening, what appointments were happening, when we had to be at places. If the clinic needed to be phoned for some information, I would do that. And it was just, for me, that was my way, really, of making myself useful, important. What, you know, it's all of these things, and trying to reduce that guilt.
Yeah, 100%. I would, I just distinctly remember we went out for dinner, and me and Jenna, we had a chat about how we would do it. We made it like feel as normal as possible. We went out, we had dinner. We went to a little Italian restaurant up by our flat at the time, and we just sat and we discussed it as if it was something we just both had to do together. How are we going to do it? I'll do this because it will make me feel a bit more comfortable with it. Can you track what this is, this, you know, what volume you're supposed to put in today, Jen? Because I struggled with that bit. So Jen was like, oh yeah, I'll do that. So we just had that open discussion, and it's a bit of advice I'll give anyone listening that's about to go into their first cycle. Sit down and really have a chat, make a point about it, about how you can support each other. Make a plan, stick to it, like you did, buddy, in terms of, you know, you knew what your role was in that process, and it will make it feel that little bit more manageable, and that you've got that little bit more control.
That's the assisted reproduction side, the IVF, and I said the umbrella term of fertility treatment. And then there's the alternate routes that you may take. So in my case, for example, we did talk about should my microtesy not yield any results, which it didn't, obviously, where would we go after that? And we discussed both donor sperm and adoption. Jenna said, you know, like, why don't we do adoption? And then we're both kind of in the same boat, if you know what I mean, in terms of she's not having her genetics passed on as well, and we're both going to deal with that side. And I felt that I really wanted to see her go through a pregnancy and experience that. And because she had no fertility issues. Her fertility was all like on point. I just felt that it would be a shame in that circumstance not to at least try. I was not against adoption at all. I just felt that after a lot of soul searching, and perhaps this is something we'll address in future episodes as well, but just how I came to be accepting of using donor sperm, I was like, no, I'd love to try that and see her carry a baby and play, like then experience that for myself as well. And I felt that would help with my bonding. I was not against adoption at all. I know people that have done it, and I speak to someone almost every day at work who's got two beautiful children who she adopted both of. They're now about 11 and 7. She adopted both of them when they were like babies, and it's the same as me with my donor conceived children. She is their mum. Like, yeah, no, I know the dad as well a little bit, but they're the parents, and they're so happy, and they've raised two beautiful children, and so yeah, like I've having seen that in other aspects as well, I was more than willing to like go down that route should we need to, and should it be a pathway that we both wanted to do. And I'm not sure if you had any considerations with them.
Yeah, I mean, we talked before we were planning this episode, didn't we, about the options, and adoption is one of them. Me and Jen discussed it, and I think if ICSI hadn't have been successful, we may have gone down the adoption route. And the reason for that is that Jen's sister is actually adopted, so we've seen firsthand. Well, Jen, when she was younger, saw firsthand, and I've seen, you know, as an adult, how wonderful adoption can be for the family and also for the individual. We've both openly talked to each other, mate, about how we're not experts in adoption, because, you know, you and me haven't been through it. So we kind of plan to do an episode on that at some point, get someone in to talk about that. I think it will be the right thing to do, because there will be people that listen to this who that is what they choose to do. We need to do it the conversation justice in terms of really what stuff people need to know. But for this conversation, at least, like, we discussed it. It was an option. We didn't have to take it up. So kind of that's when the door shut for us. It wasn't an option after that. But I think it's something that as all couples should at least discuss, because it is an option. And then you're aware that it's there. Many people don't go down that route because they have success or they choose donor sperm like you guys did.
Yeah. And like you said, we'll get someone on who's experienced it firsthand and can talk about it. But what I do know is that it's yet another kind of almost toxic phrase that can be thrown about when people are dealing with fertility issues. Oh, you can just adopt. Well, there's no just about it. This is a human life you're talking about. And also, from what I do know from my friend at work, is that it's a very long and hard process.
Yes,
to do that.
It is. It is a very long process. I've got friends that are, you know, going through it at the moment, and you don't just give children to anybody. It's a real hard process. And I think when you go through a process like that, there's a lot of questions you have to ask yourself, deep questions, and be ready for a lot of questioning. But I think, you know, we've kind of brushed it today. I don't want to go too down the rabbit hole because, as we said, we're not really experts in it. So we will cover that another day.
Well, one thing I do have firsthand experience.
That's what I was about to say, young man.
It's donor sperm. And so with that, again, it's something that you don't just jump into. It's not just use donor sperm. It's a huge decision to make because, again, there's hopefully on the other end of it, children involved. And it gets to the point where any conversation about you as a couple who are going through fertility treatment, the conversation then has to kind of take this shift to future children and putting yourself in their shoes 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you know, a lifetime down the road, because suddenly it's not just about you two, it's about who you could be bringing into the world as well. So you have to make every decision with the future best interests of children involved. And for us, we knew we would love wholly and go all in with donor sperm. And like I said, some of my reasons for wanting to do that as well was to see Jenna experience carrying a baby and childbirth as well. So yeah, it's not just a plaster that fixes infertility. You can't just paper over the cracks, because you have to do that real deep inner work to really understand why you're doing it and the reasons behind it. Because what if you rush into it and you do it just because you want a child, but you haven't really considered the implications, then that, I believe, can really have an impact down the line. And because you have to bear in mind just how easy it is these days to find out DNA history, family background, ancestry.com and all that. And that was a key part of our, you have in the UK, you have to have mandatory implications counselling, it's called, before selecting a donor. And we were going into that, we were still unsure. We were 100% were all in on the fact that we were going to use a donor, but we were unsure as to whether we would disclose to any future children their background. But coming out of that, the counsellor opened our eyes hugely to the implications should the children find out, and just how easy it is to find out. And actually, a great point she made is that it actually might not necessarily be them seeking out further information or doing ancestry checks or DNA checks or whatever. It can be other people who are doing it who do know their background and their history, and they find out through DNA links that they are half siblings or whatever relation to your donor conceived children, and contact them. So you can imagine the kind of the fallout of that and previous generations. So for example, should my parents have needed this 40 odd years ago, they were all being advised to not tell. And what's coming out of that now is a whole generation of young adults who are finding out because of how science has moved on. And they're now finding out, and it's extremely traumatic. So, but you know, everyone's decision has to be the right decision for them as a family. So I'm not here to preach, but I'm just saying what firmly changed our mind as what we feel the right thing to do is, and that's to tell early and tell often. And also part of that comes down to the fact that in the UK, since 2005, there are no anonymous donors. Donors cannot be financially compensated other than their expenses. And they have to provide details that when the donor-conceived child reaches 18, they can request it and find out the name, date of birth, and last known address. So because that came in 2005, we are now hitting that point where the initial 18-year-olds are now turning that age where they can find out. So that's something which anyone considering that has to really give serious thought to, because it's real, you know. It's but it's also important to know that it's a wonderful gift that donors are giving, but they don't have parental responsibility anyway. The names don't go on the birth certificates or anything like that. So, you know, they are your children. But it's just important to know that those details can be sought out. I mean, from 16, the donor-conceived children can find out a certain amount of information, but it wouldn't necessarily be enough to identify the person. Right. That's when they're 18. Essentially, what they can find out at 16 is what's available to the donor recipient parents when they're choosing. So I think perhaps I'll touch a little bit upon how that process works. When we decided to use a donor, we chose to stay in-house at the clinic we were at in Bournehall, because they had an in-house sperm bank. So it was reducing an element of stress by staying in-house. But I mean, people can and do import sperm from all over the world. I know there's a huge market in America, a huge market in Scandinavia. And certainly in America, you can have anonymous donors and have that shipped over. But no, we knew that in the UK that wasn't an option for us. So we started out with, we selected the kind of the biometric data that we wanted, and at this point, this is still when we were undecided about whether we'd be telling or not. So we went pretty much straight down the middle of both of us. We weren't trying to recreate a replica me, because I had come to terms with the fact that that was now not, I couldn't pass on that. So I wasn't trying to just recreate me with exactly the same eyes and hair. We wanted a child or children to fit in with us as a family. And plus, you know, the thing is, well, with my wife's side of the family, they're all, like, the resemblance is crazy. So even my two brother-in-laws my brother-in-law and sister-in-law, who have married into my wife's side of the family, their children still resemble hugely my wife's side. So, you know, that's through, like, natural conception. So there's no guarantee that I'm ever going to pass on resemblance anyway, because it seems to be that is so strong on my wife's side anyway. But so, yeah, we went kind of average of both of us, and then the clinic matched that, and we were given a choice of six donors that matched all of the criteria that we chose. Now, I've heard of situations where people, for example, are shopping for sperm in America, where there's thousands of choices. And for me, that would create a bit of anxiety, like you have a lot, too much choice almost. So I'm pleased that we only had six. And there's mandatory data that the donors have to provide, which is their biometric style, like their characteristics, like height, weight, eye color, any known medical history. They'll be checked for infections when donating, like your normal, like, big hitters, like HIV, gonorrhea, syphilis, etc. So that's all checked anyway. And the family history of any known medical conditions. So that's all mandatory information that they have to provide. And then there's optional, and which is kind of like a pen picture of who they are as a person, their characteristics. And out of ours, I can't remember if I covered this in my episode or not, but this is, you know, still relevant now. But out of our six, two provided a lot of detail about who they are as a person, their family background, why they were donating. And it was very heartwarming. They were donating because they were experiencing fertility issues on the female side, and they wanted to give back because they were so grateful of receiving donor eggs. And we were, as humans, we were drawn to them because it was just, yeah, as I said, it was heartwarming. And then a third one gave a little bit of background, but hadn't written much, maybe a couple of sentences. And then the other three were blank. So after initially being very drawn to those two that wrote really nice stories and just saying that they really hope that they can provide a happy family to someone else, we were drawn to them. But in the end, we decided to go for one of the ones that had a blank profile, because we didn't want to have any kind of expectation for who our children might be. We wanted them to be who they are, a blank canvas, flourish and help them flourish into exactly who they are as a person, and obviously nurture them the best we can as well. So this isn't the case, by the way, but for example, say one of the donors was a professional footballer or a sportsman or any, you know, something like that, we wouldn't want to be then subconsciously, because I'm sure it would happen, be like thrusting a football at them all the time. Yeah. I wonder, like, whether they ever choose to kick a ball in their lives, as much as I love football, is up to them, because it's always going to be solely about them. So that's what we chose in the end, and I wouldn't change a thing about that.
Do you know, mate, like, it's, I don't know much about the donor route. I said about the adoption, it was something that we discussed, but we didn't have to go down that route. But it sounds awfully complex, and I think that it's definitely something that we need to do an episode on. I think there's a real need, like, to cover it in, like, 15, 20 minutes doesn't do it justice.
No.
But it's really interesting to get like an insight into that thought process that you went through and the process, actual physical process. But as you said right at the beginning, it's you know, coming to terms or processing that that's what you're going to be doing. It's almost that big conversation that many men kind of need to hear, if that makes sense. But it's an amazing thing that you've just, you know, talked about. I did have a question, but I was so intrigued with what you were saying. I kind of like had this image in my head of, you know, what would it feel like to kind of get six options? Like, how was that presented to you? Was it on bits of paper, or did you get like documents on people? There's so many questions running through my mind that I'm going to
literally just paper. We've still got the one that we chose. We've still got the sheet for it.
Yeah.
Page of A4.
And you and like you talk to regularly to the children about it. Do they know now, or have you not kind of gone into that yet with them?
They're too young for that. Yeah. We've got some books that tell a story of sperm donation.
Right.
And one of Jenna's best friends is an extremely talented artist. So we got her, because of the books always had just one kid in. So we got her to draw in a second kid, is like exactly mirroring the artwork on the book.
Right. Okay.
Because we wanted to make we didn't know we were going to have twins, of course, but we wanted it to be about, it was the two of them, because we didn't want to have a book with one. This is the things that your mind plays on you when you go on through these complex routes to parenthood. We didn't want to have one kid in the book. And then when we're talking to them, they'll go, well, which one of us is that? Which one did you want? And of course, like, that may never come up, but you just play out these scenarios because you go through so much pain and you're covering off things. But you know, it's a lovely thing. It's a lovely gift that she's done for us. So thank you, Lindsay, if you ever listen to this. She'd give me a stick if I didn't mention her.
You better, mate. You better.
Yeah.
But
it's really good. And, you know, we will read them, those books, when it's time.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, like, I get asked that a lot from people on Instagram, is like, are you telling them when are you going to start? But the thing is, like, they're not going to understand now.
No.
They're too young. They're not even 3 yet. And I think a lot of people, again, it's what's right for you as a person, but a lot of people might start earlier. And I think a part of that is getting used to seeing as the adult, as the parent, getting used to telling the story.
Mm-hmm.
But because I've been telling my story now for 3 years and now we're doing the pod, I am, and my wife as well, we're completely comfortable with our rationale, our choices, what we did. So I don't need to practice it or rehearse it, because I talk about it all the time. Yeah. So I think for me, that I'll tell them when I'll start introducing it, you know, when I believe that we'll know when the time's right to start bringing in a few things, but we're nowhere near that. Yeah, we're still talking about mermaids and unicorns all the time. So.
Hey, mate, that sounds like perfect things to talk about. I think it's not just with like, donor sperm either, though. I remember distinctly kind of thinking, when do we tell the children, like, because it will come up at some point, they'll do it in school, they'll cover it somewhere, and I think Sibby was around about 4.5, 5 when we first started to have those conversations. But like, you're already probably unconsciously laying the foundations to have those conversations, like with the book and talking through on the podcast and everything you do. There's ways of preparing yourself without actually telling the children. Yeah. The main thing, mate, like we were talking about, obviously the pathways. And I think you've given a great description of that donor pathway. But it's just left me with so many questions. And I know that we've got we haven't got much time to go through it, if any time. But we definitely need to revisit this, because I think there'll be so many people out there that will have so many questions similar to me. Because it's a new world to me. It's something I never kind of had to go into. And I know that I'm thinking these questions that listeners will be listening, who are listening, will be thinking as well.
Yeah.
So thanks for that. Really, like we said before, it's a brief stop, isn't it? Or brief cover of everything that goes on.
Yeah. But it's like we said at the outset, what we wanted to do in today's episode was give people a bit of knowledge about what is likely to come up in any fertility journey. And because we just had no idea. And I wish that I had been more informed, like Jenna was, and I know your Jen was as well.
Yeah.
Because they did that, but I wasn't in a place where I could do that. But hopefully by people just hearing it and just getting in that little nugget of information and just having a bit of a better foresight as to what might come, it can only be a help.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to echo that right now. I didn't necessarily have to have all the information, but I would have just liked a little bit of information before it all kicked off. And just so I knew kind of what roughly I could prepare myself for. And hopefully this episode's done that for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that brings us to a tidy little conclusion there.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.